shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians, called to a higher level of understanding, will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Sagas of the South. The Mounted Maniac, General William T. Sherman, The Jewish Contribution to the Conduct of War. Letter from General Sherman to General Grant, January 1865. Quote, "Our method of warfare is different from that in Europe. We are not fighting against enemy armies, but against an enemy people. Both young and old, rich and poor must feel the iron hand of war in the same way as the organized armies. In this respect, my march through Georgia was a wonderful success." End quote. Both the date and the author of this letter must appear extraordinary to every Christian. How could an American general write such a monstrous thing at that particular time? The most noble minds and hearts of the Aryans were then making every effort to humanize warfare as far as possible. On the other hand, the son of a lawyer, General William Tecumseh Sherman, had invented a new warfare that was directed against the civilian population. The Jewish-trained Sherman was the inventor of locust strategy. His doctrine was, "Where I have been, the war has ceased, because all forms of life no longer exist. It involves nothing more nor less than the suppression of humane warfare." General Robert E. Lee said, "There are things a gentleman does not do." Sherman's strategy is the art of war employed by the unsuccessful. It is necessary to bear this in mind when considering Sherman's methods. He was unsuccessful, but by no means untalented. It was his fate always to have to fight against enemies better than himself. He never won a success against an enemy of equal strength. He usually fought against weaker foes and was defeated by their superior military ability. He owed his greatest military success, the occupation of the town of Atlanta, not to his own skill, but to a mistake made by his enemy. In the order of the day to his troops after the occupation of Atlanta, on the 8th of September, 1864, Sherman said, quote, "We must admit that the enemy opposed us with skill and endurance. At last he made the long-awaited mistake and sent his cavalry to our rear much too far to be able to recall them. The price of his mistake, as we have already said, was Atlanta, the capital of Georgia. The enemy general evacuated the town after realizing his error. Sherman found only wounded men incapable of further fighting. He was ambitious and had grown tired of such wretched successes. He therefore continued the war in accordance with an idea he had already learned from the Jews some time before. We are discussing what is known as the War of Secession. Superficially, the war was being fought on the question of the abolition of slavery. The North supposedly wished to give back their liberty to the Negro slaves in the South. The result was that by the end of the war, 100,000 Negroes were fighting against the armies of the Northern liberators. There is no need for us to delve into the events leading up to the war at this time. temperament and Jewish religious fanaticism converted into one of the bloodiest massacres in history. There were many innovations both on land and at sea. Landmines were employed on a large scale, and armored warships made their first appearance. Force of arms alone could not decide the war. It was not until Sherman employed his locust strategy that the northern states won the victory. The end of Atlanta, the beautiful town among the hills of Georgia, was the signal for the commencement of the new era. On the 5th of September, 1864, Cogswell, the commander of Atlanta, appointed by Sherman, ordered the inhabitants to evacuate the town. These instructions were couched in the following terms, quote, "All the families living in Atlanta, the male members of which are serving with the Confederates or have gone to the South, are to leave the town within 5 days. They will be allowed to pass through the lines towards the South. All citizens from the North not belonging to the Army or having the permission of Generals Sherman or Thomas are to leave the town within the same period. Anybody found in the town afterwards will be imprisoned." End of quote. Nobody at first believed the truth of this order, for nobody apart from Sherman knew what it meant. Who could have suspected that this order was the first step along a path never yet trodden in history? General Hood, Sherman's opponent, was also informed of this measure by letter. At the same time, he was offered an armistice. Hood replied, quote, "General, I have received your letter of yesterday from the hands of citizens Bull and Crewe. You say in it, quote, 'It is in the interest of the Union that the people of Atlanta should leave the town. I have no alternative and consequently accept your proposal for a 10-day armistice and will do everything in my power to remove the people of Atlanta to the South. And now allow me to say that this measure, which is without precedent, exceeds in calculated and intentional cruelty everything in the dark history of warfare. I protest in the name of God and humanity against your driving the women and children of a brave people from their homes and hearths." End quote. The citizens of Atlanta protested together with General Hood. General Sherman answered them the same way he answered General Hood. He wrote to them as follows, quote, "Gentlemen, I have received your letter of 11th and the request for the withdrawal of my order. I have read it carefully and believe all the sufferings you mention, which will be the consequence of its execution, and yet I do not withdraw it. In order to end the war, we must annihilate the army of the rebels who have revolted against the law and the Constitution. In order to annihilate them, we must push forward to the places where they produce their arms and equipment and store their supplies. Atlanta cannot simultaneously serve military purposes and be a safe place for families. From now on, there will be no trade, no industry, and no agriculture there. A shortage will soon come about and force the families to move away. Why not rather go now, when all preparations have been made and the removal is facilitated, instead of waiting until the fire of both armies renews the scenes of the previous month? I cannot communicate to you my next plans, but you cannot believe that the army will remain here quietly, and I can tell you that my plans make necessary your removal, which I will now facilitate for you in every way." End quote. There was, however, one man to whom Sherman had communicated his plans. This was Lieutenant General Grant, the commander-in-chief of the northern states. Sherman had sent a messenger to him bearing a letter with several seals. It was very dangerous to send this letter, but Sherman had to do it if he did not wish to expose himself to utter condemnation. He was looking for somebody to relieve him of the responsibility, and Grant accepted it because Sherman promised him victory. In his letter, Sherman did not write everything, for otherwise Grant, who liked to emphasize his Christianity, would not have consented after all. Sherman told everything only a few weeks later, when the new strategy had already proved successful, and Grant, intoxicated by victory, could not draw back if he did not wish to relinquish fresh victories. Sherman said that it was foolish to continue the war in the manner of a normal campaign, as had been the case so far. The way the war was being fought meant that you were continually dependent on the enemy. Wherever you advanced or retreated, you always had to reckon with the enemy. The war could only be brought to a close by surprise operations, and such surprise operations could only be carried out if the enemy was prevented from sticking at your heels. Sherman said that it was his intention to disappear without the enemy being in a position to follow him. It was his aim to reappear somewhere else by surprise. But how would it be possible to shake off the enemy? It is necessary to destroy his supply base, was Sherman's answer. Quote, I will sow economic ruin throughout the country so that no soldier coming after me will find anything to eat, end quote. Georgia and its capital, Atlanta, had already been very much weakened by the war. Sherman consequently wrote to Grant as follows, quote, until we can repopulate Georgia, it is useless to defend it, but the complete destruction of its roads, its buildings, its population, and its military resources is essential. The attempt to defend its roads costs us 1,000 men every month and brings us no advantages. I can carry out the march and make Georgia howl, end quote. Grant requested Sherman to express himself more precisely, and Sherman answered, quote, Hood can go to Kentucky and Tennessee, but I believe he will be forced to follow me. Instead of being on the defensive, I shall be on the offensive. Instead of guessing at what he intends, I shall compel him to guess my plans. This makes a difference of 25% in warfare. I can turn in the direction of Savannah, Charleston, or the mouth of the Chattahoochee. I prefer to march through Georgia to the sea, destroying everything on my way. Therefore, if you hear that I have set off, order scouts in Morris Island, Oshawa Sound, Pensacola, and Mobile Bay, shall turn up again somewhere, and believe me, I can take Macon, Milledgeville, Augusta, Savannah, and then appear again behind Charleston so that I can starve it out. This operation is not purely military and strategical, but it will show the South's weakness, end quote. It is necessary to listen to these two letters carefully in order to understand Sherman's real purpose. They are written by one soldier to another soldier in soldier's language. A clever soldier is writing to his not quite so clever superior. Without absolutely telling him lies, he yet conceals his intentions in the technical language with which they are both familiar. On one occasion, he pretends that he wishes to adopt the defensive and consequently must destroy Atlanta. He acts as if he wished to prevent his enemy from pursuing him. It has always been thus since the days of classical antiquity. A retreating army destroys everything that could be of use to the advancing army. Sherman proposes this old defensive rule to his superior. In the next letter, however, he writes, quote, Instead of being on the defensive, I shall be on the offensive. For in military language, that is the advantage of the initiative, end quote. Now, why, if he wishes to launch an offensive, does he destroy everything as he advances? Only during his retreat would a normal soldier destroy everything that might be of use to the enemy. The truth is that Sherman wished to act on the offensive, but not against the enemy's army. He wished to make the land of Georgia howl, not the army of Georgia, of which he was afraid. He was planning a bold crime and covertly indicated his intention in the words, quote, "This operation is not purely military and strategical." Well, Sherman had his way. Atlanta was evacuated and razed to the ground according to a carefully thought-out plan. Sherman was in command of 60,000 men. This army had supplies for 30 days and consequently did not need to forage. Sherman divided his army up into four corps and two wings and gave them orders to march parallel to one another. Two corps were thus always marching together, the whole in four columns, right across the country, flanked by cavalry and mounted batteries. Their commander was General Kilpatrick. It was he who issued the order that only the ruins of houses should show to coming generations that Kilpatrick's cavalry had passed that way. By the 14th of November, 1864, every man in Sherman's army was on the march, and only the demolition party was left in the deserted city. Sherman sent off a last telegram to Washington saying, quote, "All is well," end quote. And then the telegraph station was blown sky high to be followed by the town of Atlanta. Sherman and his 60,000 men now disappeared even from the eyes of Washington. In the middle of December, the ghostly army reappeared near Savannah. The 60,000 men had covered the 220 miles from Atlanta to the sea like a whirlwind. Behind them, they dragged along an army of starving Negroes, whom they could not very well shake off because, after all, they had come as the liberators of the slaves. The last bonds of discipline were shaken off by Sherman's troops, and they lost the name of soldier. Sherman, after his march through Georgia, wrote a letter to Grant containing the frightful words, quote, "We are not fighting against enemy armies, but against an enemy people. Both young and old, rich and poor, must feel the iron hand of war in the same way as the organized armies. In this respect, my march through Georgia was a wonderful success," end of quote. On its march, Sherman's army confiscated $100 million worth of grain and cattle. Just imagine how much $100 million was in those days. The troops used $20 million worth for themselves, and the remainder was destroyed, while our southern brethren, their wives and children, were starving. This figure includes only the food supplies. The destroyed houses, roads, and equipment have never been calculated. This, quote, "wonderful success," end quote, stimulated the other generals. Sheridan, one of Grant's cavalry generals, destroyed 100,000 bushels of wheat, 50,000 bushels of maize, 6,200 tons of hay, and 11,000 head of cattle in Rockingham County alone. For years after the conclusion of peace, the people in the southern states, who had formerly been so rich, were still clad in rags. Grant was delighted when he heard the news of Sherman's appearance. He immediately sent him a new plan of campaign. Sherman was to make his way by the quickest route, that is to say, via the sea, to Grant in order to support him in his hard struggle against the great General Lee of the southern states and his wonderful, fearless cavalry. But Sherman did not come. Grant did not yet understand. He still believed that Sherman was longing to fight. But Sherman did not want to fight, only when there was no other alternative. Sherman had long ago relinquished all military ambitions and cut himself off from every conception of soldierly honor. He had become a violent criminal who wished to confer victory on his country's politics, whatever it cost the enemy. War is the continuation of politics by other means. Sherman adapted this axiom and made of it is the continuation of politics by every means. There we have Sherman's terrible originality. He had converted war from being an act of violence against an enemy army to an act of violence against an enemy people. He went even further and made of it an act of total violence. Even violence has limits imposed on it by morality. Sherman had intentionally disappeared with his entire army, and far removed from all control and all protest, had led war across the limit set even on violence into the zone of unbridled crime. When he reappeared, Savannah fell, and the world regarded this as a sign of Sherman's bravery and of his military genius. What had really happened in Georgia was learned after the conclusion of peace by only a few people. The world was scarcely interested in it, for in Europe, war broke out between France and Germany, and moreover, Jewish propaganda ensured that the world was fed with touching stories from Uncle Tom's cabin. During the time he spent in Georgia, Sherman enriched the history of tactics by only one feature, but that alone should have sufficed to exclude him from the company of decent people. He had prisoners of war put onto carts, which had to drive along in front of his own troops. If they were blown up, Sherman knew that a minefield lay ahead. He answered all protests against his cruel treatment of defenseless people with the icy coldness characteristic of all his writings. Sherman sent a letter in which he explained his own new plan to Grant, who was still waiting for him in vain. He did not want to cross the sea as Grant had ordered, so as to fight against Lee, but wished to march through Carolina and devastate it like Georgia. No, not like Georgia, but far more cruelly, far more thoroughly, in fact, totally. He wrote as follows, quote, "Certainly Jefferson Davis, the president of the Southern states, keeps his people well disciplined. But I think that confidence in him has been shattered in Georgia, and it soon will be in South Carolina. The whole army, moreover, is eager to be revenged on South Carolina. I tremble when I think of its approaching fate, but I know that it has deserved everything that is coming to it." End of quote. With a trembling heart, never has anybody scorned noble feelings with more blasphemy. Sherman gave his army the order to break camp. The instructions were to destroy roads, horses, and people. Once more, the army moved off along a wide front in four columns. Behind it lay the devastated region of Georgia, and before it the prosperous and rich area of Carolina. No revenger could follow Sherman, for how could he have fed himself? Sheridan said cynically, quote, "Even the crows have to bring their food with them," end quote. The marauders of General Sherman's army called themselves, quote, "bummers," end quote. In name, they were soldiers, but actually it was 60,000 bandits and bums who marched through Georgia and Carolina, stealing more than they could eat themselves. Roads, horses, and people are to be destroyed. Acting in accordance with the Talmudic orders, they burnt everything they found and even took the poultry away with them. In the southern states of the United States of America, where the horrors of 1864 to 1865 were perpetrated by order of the Jews, are not forgotten. I am ashamed to say we Americans repeated the same mistake in World War II on our Aryan, German, Christian brethren by again following the orders of the Antichrist Jews. Let's go back to the year 1863, to the greatest battle the Confederacy ever fought. It was a total victory for the South. That battle was the Battle of Chancellorsville. At the end of April 1863, General Hooker, of the Union Army began to threaten Fredericksburg and cross the upper Rappahannock to come behind Lee. A Confederate force of two divisions under Anderson, reinforced by Jackson's command, entrenched along a three-mile front and arrested the progress of Hooker's flanking movement on May 1, 1863. Meeting with such unexpected resistance, Hooker abandoned the initiative and fell back to entrench along a five-mile front in the vicinity of Chancellorsville. Lee advanced cautiously on the afternoon of May 1st to take a position along the old Furnace Road. At Fredericksburg, Lee had left approximately 10,000 men under General Jubal Early to guard the heights against Sedgwick's federal force of about 25,000 men. Among the pines at the junction of the Orange Plank and Furnace Roads is located the site of the last bivouac of Lee and Jackson. Here on the night of May 1st, 1863, the generals planned the Battle of Chancellorsville, one of the most daringly conceived engagements of the war. Here they parted company for the last time. The next morning, Jackson moved out on the bold maneuver that divided the Confederate Army. The leading regiments of Jackson's command reached the halfway point at about 12:30 p.m. From here, they pushed northward to the Plank Road, where Jackson met Fitzhugh Lee, the cavalryman. The two generals rode eastward on a reconnaissance along the Plank Road to a hilltop that revealed the completely exposed nature of the Federal right. Returning, Jackson quickly gave the order to continue the advance to the Orange Turnpike and thence eastward toward Chancellorsville. At approximately 2 miles from the Union forces, on May 2nd, 1863, Jackson's veterans, without shoes, with bloody feet, and no food, stretched in massed columns a mile on either side of the turnpike, struck Howard's Federal Corps about 6 p.m. The crushing, irresistible attack of these dedicated men hurled back Hooker's right 2 miles toward Chancellorsville. The withdrawal of Sickles' Federal Corps early that morning permitted the Confederates to seize the best positions and establish a heavy concentration of artillery, which enfiladed part of the Federal line and raked the strongly entrenched Federal position at Fairview. Lee rode to Hazel Grove at 10 a.m. to supervise the assault on Fairview. All positions were finally carried by storm at about 10 a.m. Chancellorsville, a smoking ruin, then fell into Confederate hands. It must be remembered that this Confederate force was outnumbered by over 2-1. The Union forces were fully equipped, well-fed, and 130,000 strong, whereas the Southern forces were ill-fed, very poorly equipped, and only 60,000 in number. What made the difference? These men were able to rout a numerically superior army due to the fact that they believed in their cause, states' rights, and the liberty of men. These men died for you. If they had not fought, the international Jew communists would have removed all your rights, and this nation and all its people would have been in slavery long ago. Especially attractive to the marauding Federals were the great plantations owned by the rich. One of these was on the Ogeechee River near Louisville, about 100 miles northwest of Savannah. Its mistress explains that she and her elderly husband, the judge, actually spent most of their time in Macon, where they had another fine home, but were on the plantation during the days of Sherman's march. Quote, "About the 24th of November, we heard that Sherman's army were in possession of Milledgeville and were on their way to Savannah, burning and destroying everything in their course. A few days afterward, Kilpatrick's cavalry passed us, coming no nearer than 6 miles, and when they had passed, we hoped the main army would do the same. We thought it best, however, to take such precaution to conceal our stock so as to prevent them from being found if they should make us a visit. And stockades were built in the dense swamp of the Ogeechee, impenetrable, as we thought, to anyone not acquainted with the surroundings. For several days, squads of cavalry, Wheeler's command, would pass and tell us where Sherman's army were and of the depredations they were committing, and warn us to prepare for the worst, as they were showing no mercy. And on Sunday, the 28th of November, we heard that the destroyers were encamped just above our upper plantation, about 4 miles from our home. That night, the heavens looked as if they were on fire from the glare of burning houses, and early Monday morning, a Negro man came from the upper plantation and told us they were crossing the river, and some of them were at Louisville, about 2 miles off. Also that they were searching the houses, breaking open the stores, and setting fire to them, and killing all the stock they could find. He proposed to hide a number of hams we had hanging up in the smokehouse, and we gladly accepted the proposition. He accordingly dug down about 2 feet, laid planks at the bottom of the excavation, and placed the hams on them, covering them up securely and putting syrup barrels over the place. I told the cook to prepare enough food to last us several days, as we would not be able to have anything cooked while the Federals were on the place. We also gave the Negroes a month's rations, thinking they would be better able to keep it than we would. That morning, the overseer's wife and myself had gone into the woods and buried my valuables. The judge was in the swamp at the time, having the stock put in the stockade and turning the fattening hogs out in the swamp, thinking that they would be less liable to be killed running at large. He had his watch with him. When he came back to the house, I got the watch from him and gave it to the overseer's wife with the request that she would hide it in some safe place. About noon, just as we were ready to sit down to dinner, a little Negro boy came running in, half breathless from fright. "Massa," he cried, "dey's coming down de lane." "Who is coming?" asked his master. "Two white mans with blue coats on," the little Negro answered. We left the dining room and looked out. Instead of two white men with blue coats, we saw about a dozen at the Negro houses talking to the Negroes. My husband went out, and two of them came up and spoke very politely to him, asking if he could let them have something to eat. They said they wanted some flour and were willing to pay for what they got. They looked around the pantry and smokehouse, and one of them said, "You had better have those provisions carried into your house. Some of our men are not very particular to ask for what they want." Another offered to take down some pieces of meat that were hanging up in the smokehouse and bring them into the house for me. I began to think they were not so bad after all, but I soon had reason to change my mind. We hardly got the meat inside the house before hundreds of the blue coats could be seen everywhere. One man came up to me and asked if I could tell him how long since the last Rebs passed the place. I made no reply to him, whereupon he cursed me and demanded to know why I did not answer his question. "Don't you know that Southern women know no such persons as Rebs?" another soldier observed. "Then," said the first, "will you please tell me, madam, how long since the last Confederate soldiers passed here?" I told him General Wheeler's men had been passing for several days, and that some of them had passed that morning. "I suppose," I added, "that they are waiting for you down in the swamp," and I hoped in my heart that they would give them a warm reception. In our fright, we had forgotten our dinner. And when we went back into the dining room, everything was gone. Not a morsel of anything to eat was left. The dishes were all gone, and even the tablecloth was taken. They no doubt were very much delighted to find a nice dinner already prepared for them. A large turkey, a ham, and various other things nicely cooked. We were too much frightened to feel hungry then. As we were outside the picket line, we were not molested during the night. The army regulations were very strict, requiring all to be in camp before dark. That night, about 9 o'clock, we heard a slight knocking on the window. "Who is that?" asked my husband. "A friend," was the answer. "I am a Confederate soldier." Upon opening the door, a young Confederate officer came in. He had been hiding in the woods all day, and he came to ask us if we could direct him to a safe place in which to conceal himself until the enemy passed by. The judge directed him to a place in the woods in which he thought he might be able to hide without much danger of being discovered. The young man accordingly provided himself with some water and set out, having avoided letting the overseer or any of the Negroes know of his visit. Early Tuesday morning, the Federals began to come in from every quarter. One could not look in any direction without seeing them. They searched every place. One of them loudly declared that he had heard we had a Confederate officer concealed in the house and that he was determined to find him. The intruders thereupon looked into closets, trunks, boxes, and every conceivable place. One man came in and said, "I know you have got a rebel officer hidden away in here somewhere. He was seen to come in here last night." He accordingly began to search the bureau drawers and even opened the clock and looked into that. "Sir," I said, just as he was about to leave the room, "there is one place in the room that you have not looked into." "Where is that?" he asked. I pointed to a small pillbox on the mantel and asked him if the Confederate soldier might not be hidden in that. He turned away with a curse upon all rebel women. About noon, some of them insisted that my husband should go down to the swamp with them to show them where some syrup was hidden. He called a Negro man who had assisted in hiding it and told him to go, but the Federals insisted that he should go himself. He told them he was old and feeble and not able to walk so far. One of them thereupon went and brought a mule and put him on it, and three of them started with him to the swamp. I felt very uneasy about him, but was assured by some of the soldiers that no harm would be done him. While my husband was absent, the destroyers set fire to the gin house, in which were stored over 200 bales of cotton and several bales of kersey, which we had hidden between the bales of cotton. The granary, in which were several hundred bushels of wheat, was also set on fire. The Negroes went out and begged for the cloth, saying that it was to make their winter clothes. The cruel destroyers refused to let the Negroes have a single piece. They told them they knew it was to make clothes for the Rebs. One man, who had been particularly insulting, came up to me and laughed harshly. "Well, madam," he said sneeringly, "how do you like the looks of our little fire? We have seen a great many such within the last few weeks." I had grown desperate and told him I didn't care, that I was thankful that a lock of that cotton would ever feed a Federal factory or clothe a Federal soldier's back. He turned with an oath and left me, but after a few minutes came back, having discovered that my home was in the city of Macon and that I had heard nothing from there in some time, and told me, with a chuckle, that the army had passed through Macon, had sacked it, and then burned it to the ground. A rough-looking Western man was standing by, and he interrupted him. "Madam," he asked, "have you friends in Macon?" I told him I had a home and a brother there. He then turned to the miscreant and looked him squarely in the eyes. "Why," he demanded, "do you lie so to this lady? You know we did not touch Macon, but passed it by. God knows she will have enough to bear before this army leaves here without being made the target of lies." I am glad you have a home outside of Sherman's track, he continued, addressing me, for heaven knows you will need it before many days pass. You will have nothing left here. Just then I saw my husband coming up on a bareback mule with a federal soldier on each side of him holding him on. He was brought up to the piazza, lifted from the mule, and brought into the house. They took him into a small room, and I followed. He turned to me and requested me to give the men his watch. Why, I asked, they have no business with your watch. Give it to them, he repeated with a gasp, and let them go. I am almost dead. The overseer's wife was standing by, and I told her to get the watch. She, without thinking, asked me if I meant the judge's watch, and I answered yes. Of course, the federal soldiers inferred from her remark that she knew where other valuables were concealed, and they made her yield up everything. I got my husband to his room as soon as possible and found that he was very faint, as I thought, from fatigue. Imagine my horror, therefore, when he revived sufficiently to talk, to hear that the fiends had taken him to the swamp and hanged him. He said he suspected no harm until he got about 2 miles from the house, when they stopped and, taking him from the mule, said, "Now, old man, you have got to tell us where your gold is hidden." He told them he had no gold. They cursed him and told him that story would not do. He repeated he had no gold. Then they took him to a tree, then bent over the path, tied a rope around his neck, threw it over a projecting limb, and drew him up until his feet were off the ground. He did not quite lose consciousness when they let him down and said, "Now where is your gold?" He told them the same story, whereupon one of them cried, "We will make you tell another story before we are done with you. So pull him up again, boys." They raised him up again, and that time he said he felt as if he were suffocating. They again lowered him to the ground and cried out fiercely, "Now tell us where that gold is, or we will kill you, and your wife will never know what has become of you." "I have told you the truth. I have no gold," he again repeated, adding, "I am an old man, and at your mercy. If you want to kill me, you have the power to do it. But I cannot die with a lie on my lips. I have no gold. I have a gold watch at the house, but nothing else." One of them, who seemed to be the leader, said, "Swing the old rebel up again. Next time we will get the truth from him." Then they lifted him up and let him fall with more force than before. He heard a sound as of water rushing through his head, and then his blindness came over him, and a dry, choking sensation was felt in his throat as he lost consciousness. The next thing he remembered, he was some distance from the place where he was hanged, lying with his head down the hill near a stream of water. One of them was bathing his face and another rubbing his hands. For some time he was unable to speak. Then he heard one of them say, "We like to have carried that game too far." When he was able to sit up, they placed him upon the mule and brought him to the house to get his watch. When the overseer's wife went to get the judge's watch, the plunderers compelled her to guide them to the place where everything of value that we had was concealed, and she came to me when she returned to the house and with trembling lips said that she hoped I would not blame her. "I couldn't help it," she cried. "They threatened to kill me if I did not tell. They said they had hanged the judge until he was nearly dead, and they would do the same to me if I did not show them where everything was concealed." Poor woman, I did not blame her. Oh, the horror of that night. None but God will ever know what I suffered. There my husband lay with scorching fever, his tongue parched and swollen, and his throat dry and sore. He begged for water, and there was not a drop to be had. The Federals had cut all the well ropes and stolen the buckets, and there was no water nearer than half a mile. Just before daylight, one of the Negro men offered to go to the spring for some water, but there was not a bucket or a tub to be found. Everything had been carried off. He at last found a small tin bucket that some of the Negroes had used for carrying their dinner to the field, and brought that full about half a gallon. The next morning, Wednesday, a rough-looking man from Iowa came to the window and asked me if he could be of any service to me. I told the stranger that we had no water and nothing to eat. He then left, and in about an hour returned with a wooden pail. The good Samaritan then took from his pocket two envelopes, one containing about 2 tablespoonfuls of parched coffee and the other about the same quantity of brown sugar. I never appreciated a cup of coffee more than I did that one. By the time the judge had finished drinking his coffee, which he relished very much, and had bathed his face, the Federals began to pour in from every direction. Everywhere one looked, they could be seen. They were so thick in my room, I could scarcely turn around. They took everything they could find. One took the clock and started out with it. I begged him to leave it, and to my surprise, he did. But in a few minutes, another came and carried it off and threw it in the horse lot, where it was found by some of the Negroes and taken care of. Not far from the house, there were about 12 banks of potatoes that the plunderers began to carry away by the bagful. They would come into the house, take any article of clothing they could find, tie a string around one end of it, and make a receptacle to carry off potatoes. My Western friend, the Good Samaritan, who gave me the coffee, came to the door and said, "Give me a basket, and I will bring in some of those potatoes before they are all taken, for you will need them." I fortunately had a basket in the room and gave it to him. He brought in about 3 bushels and put them under the bed on the floor. All the time he was bringing in the potatoes, the soldiers were jeering him and calling him old sickish. He paid no attention to their taunts. Seeing the judge in bed, some of the worst of the riffraff insisted upon making him get up, saying they knew he had gold hidden in the bed and was only feigning sickness to keep it from being found. 2 of them came to the bed and were about to pull him out when I implored them to let him alone, telling them how he had been treated and declaring that he was not able to get up. At last I cried out, "Is there no one in this crowd of men who will protect this sick man and prevent his being killed?" One young man, about 18 years old, from New York, Colton, I afterwards learned, was his name, stepped forward bravely. "I will do my best, madam, to protect you," he said. "I have no bayonet on my gun, and they know I have no authority to act as guard. But I will stay by you and do all I can to protect you." He took his stand near the bed and declared that the first man that touched either my husband or myself would do it at the risk of his life. Just then a mean, cadaverous-looking man that had been very insulting in the morning rode up to the door and threatened to set fire to the house. He got off the mule he was riding and came in and began to curse and swear, declaring that he would pull the old rebel out of the bed anyway. I thought of my husband's being a Mason and appealed to the crowd to know if there were any Masons in the room. "No," the newcomer thundered with a horrible oath. "We have none of those animals with us. We left them at home. They are rather inconvenient to take along." "My major is a Mason," young Colton whispered, "and if I can get anyone to stay with you, I will bring him." He then said, turning to his comrades, "Can I find a man who will protect this lady and her sick husband until I come back?" The Iowa soldier, whom I have mentioned before, came in from the yard and offered to stand guard. "I will do it, but my gun is at my tent." Colton then handed him his gun, advising him to use it and knock down the first man that dared to touch my husband or myself. He then left and in a few minutes returned with an officer, whom he introduced as Colonel Winkler of Wisconsin, who was the officer of the day. I was astonished to see the room and house cleared of soldiers almost in an instant. No one remained but Colonel Winkler and young Colton. And in a short time, Colonel Winkler sent Colton to procure a guide, and we were subjected to no more insult. Colonel Winkler seemed to regret very much the treatment we had received and said if any of the men could be identified, they should be severely punished. He then sent to the camp and got coffee, sugar, rice, beef, flour, and other articles, enough to last several days. Wednesday night, for the first time since Sunday night, I lay down and slept. But my slumbers were not happy, as the judge was still suffering from the effects of the inhuman treatment he had received. His nose would bleed, and bloody water would ooze from his ears. His eyes were bloodshot and pained him greatly. Occasionally he would spit up blood, and his tongue was swollen. Early Friday morning, we rejoiced to hear that the Federals were preparing to leave. They were busy getting the army trains ready to move on. Everything was enveloped in a dense fog that morning. Nothing could be seen 50 yards off. In starting their trains, therefore, they floundered about in the fog and were going back the same way they came. About 10 o'clock, however, they got righted and resumed their, quote, grand march to the sea, unquote. Late that afternoon, the guards were withdrawn, and the last of the Federal Army disappeared. Our secreted Confederate officer came walking up just after dark Friday night. He had concealed himself during the 4 days in a cavity at the root of a large pine tree, almost entirely hidden by the small roots. He had kept closely hidden during the night and day, and rested himself by changing his position and walking around a little. The rear of the army encamped that night about 4 or 5 miles from us. We could see the glare of fires and knew from our own experience that the work of destruction was going on. Saturday morning, we looked out upon a scene of desolation and ruin. We could hardly believe it was our home. 1 week before, it was one of the most beautiful places in the state. Now it was a vast wreck. Gin houses, packing screws, granary, all lay in ashes. Not a fence was to be seen for miles. The corn crop had not been gathered prior to Sherman's coming, and the army had turned their stock into the fields and destroyed what they had not carried off. Burning cotton and grain filled the air with smoke, and even the sun seemed to hide its face from so gloomy a picture. The poor Negroes had fared no better than we had. Their northern friends had stolen everything from them as well as from us. Their master had given them a month's rations, thinking they would be able to save it. But alas, they had provisions, clothing, and everything taken from them. "Massa," they asked piteously, "what are we going to do now?" "I can't tell," he answered sadly. "It looks as if we would all have to starve together." One of the Negro women was sitting on her doorsteps, swaying her body back and forth and making a mournful noise, a kind of moaning. As we approached her, she raised her head. "Massa," she said, "what kind of folks these here Federals? They won't even let the dead rest in the grave. You know my child, what I buried last week? They take him up and left him on top of the ground for the hog to root." Her story was true. We found that the Vandals had gone to the graveyard, and seeing a new-made grave, had dug down into it and taken up the little coffin containing the Negro baby, no doubt supposing treasure had been buried there. When they discovered their mistake, they left it above ground, as the poor mother expressed it, for the hog to root. We soon discovered that almost everything we had hidden had been found, and either carried off or wantonly destroyed. All around the grove were carcasses of cows, sheep, and hogs, some with only the hindquarters gone and the rest left to spoil. The question of getting anything to eat was a very serious one. The stores were all burned, not one being left within 35 miles. The mills were all destroyed or partially so. Railroads were torn up, bridges broken. There seemed to be nothing left to live on during the winter. Oh, the 1st of December, 1864, is indelibly impressed upon my mind. We had more than 100 Negroes to feed and clothe, and to all appearances there was nothing to do it with. We almost wished all had gone with the army, as there seemed nothing but starvation left for those who remained. On Monday morning, we saw in the distance coming towards the house a
small covered wagon, such as is used by the poorer class of people in the piney woods for carrying their produce to market. Walking by the side of it was a tall, thin man in his shirt sleeves and rough straw hat. He came up to the house, and the judge recognized him, a man whom he had formerly known and befriended. "Judge," he said, "when my wife heard that the Federals had been here and destroyed all you had, she said to me, 'We can't let the judge suffer for something to eat while we have anything ourselves. Don't you remember how he helped us when we were first married? He gave us a cow and a calf and a pig and provisions to last until we could get started. As long as I have anything to eat, I will divide with him.' So she asked me to fix up the wagon and bring you something." He then began to unpack that little wagon. There was meat, meal, flour, lard, butter, chickens, and various other things, enough to keep the wolf from the door for some time to come. Tears of gratitude came into our eyes, and we could not express our thanks. They seemed perfectly happy to be able to give us this timely relief. "Don't thank us, Judge," he said over and over again. "We are only paying our just debts." Before the day was over, three more of those little covered wagons came up to our door on the same errand of love and deposited their freight as expressions of gratitude to one who had befriended them in their early married life. As they expressed it, "Help them to get a start in life." Verily, it was as bread cast upon the waters to be gathered up after many days. It was very gratifying to my husband, the judge, and dispelled the gloom and almost despair that was settling down on his spirits. He seemed to take courage from that moment and believe that the God whom he served would not forsake him, but would provide some way for him to live and feed those dependent upon him. The Jew communist plan for complete overthrow of our white Christian heritage must be stopped at all costs. May Almighty God bless you and keep you.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.